This episode is brought to you by Affinity, a relationship intelligence platform that empowers teams to find, manage, and close high-quality deals. Find out why firms like Octopus Ventures, Dawn, and First Minute Capital choose Affinity at affinity.co. Networks are everything. Don't forget to mention you're a friend of Venture Europe when you chat to the team.
Hey everybody, welcome to a new episode of Venture Europe with me, Colleen Fabry. Our guest today is Philip Dames, founding partner at Cherry Ventures. Cherry Ventures is an early-stage venture capital firm led by a team of entrepreneurs with experience in building fast-scaling companies such as Zalando and Spotify. The firm backs Europe's boldest founders, usually as their first institutional investor. They have a great track record, having previously invested in the seed stage of over 90 companies across Europe, including Flixbus, AutoOne Group, InFarm, Forto, SellerX, Juni, and Flink, just to name a few. They are based in Berlin with offices in Stockholm and London. Before Cherry, Philip started his first startup company in 2008, a digital marketplace for art and collectibles long before there were NFTs. He then joined Zalando as member of the founding team and grew the business up to IPO. During this episode, we discuss about his journey with Zalando, the founding story of Cherry Ventures, and why making the first million is the hardest. Please enjoy this excellent conversation with Philip Dames, founding partner at Cherry Ventures. Oh, wait. Sophia is calling.
Hi, Keenan. Hope you're well. This is Sophia Benz from Cherry Ventures, giving you a little soundbite about Philip. So, if I would go to an island, a deserted island, I'd bring Philip. And I would play music, we would cook some delicious food, we would discuss philosophy, we would do some boxing, some yoga. We would probably also discuss business model and the world of venture and being an entrepreneur. Other than being really good at what he's doing, he's also an amazing friend and human being. He is someone with a very positive outlook on life, and I think that is infectious. I think why he's very good at whatever he's taking on is because he is doing it with full-on sync between heart and mind and soul. Philip is someone that you want to work with and be friends with. He's an amazing human being, and I'm super happy to work with him.
Hey, Philip. Love your background. Are you at the office?
No, I actually went home because it was so noisy at the office, so many people today. So I'm sitting in my home office.
And how do you usually split between working from office, working from home? Like what is the policy that you guys have?
So we don't have a policy. We kind of trust people to work from wherever they want to work from. And anyways, in our firm, people travel a lot. So I'm an office person. I love the office. I also really missed it during COVID. So the moment we could go back, I actually spend most of my time there. Sometimes I take afternoon, go home, power through some emails and try and zoom out a little bit. But typically you find me in the office pretty much every day.
It kind of seems that the hybrid is the best solution or what most of the people prefer, right? They still want to be there maybe with their colleagues, but also they would want to have, as you say, like this deep focus. If they need like 2 to 4 hours and no emails, then maybe they'll prefer just to work from home.
Yeah. So I think it really depends on the company. There's some firms that were basically set up to be sort of remote from day one and it works well for them. In my experience, firms that haven't been remote always and then went to remote, I think very few of them found it to be the winning formula. So I think efficiency gets lost and, spending the entire day on Zoom is also, sometimes really frustrating people. And I think motivation goes down. A lot of the communication that sometimes happens between meetings isn't there. So the hybrid could be a thing. I think presence in the office, at least in our case, has definitely worked well. And people were exchanging, also on stuff that probably they wouldn't exchange on if they were just, setting up Zoom calls back to back.
Got it. And talking about your experience, I just wanted maybe to jump and focus on searching for the right idea. In 2008, according to Forbes, you founded Proto NFT. And a year later, you joined the Zalando journey fairly early. Tell me more about the process of searching for an idea worth pursuing.
Yeah, so the company we founded when I moved to Berlin in 2008, it didn't have anything to do with NFTs. It had to do with collectibles, which obviously NFTs are often used for. So we went after some of the categories that people love and people collect. So it could have been like art and antiques, but also, classic collectible items, stamps, coins, etc. And we wanted to create a concept which is much more personal than eBay, you know, create an environment where people exchange a bit of a community touch to it as well, and then combine it with new formats such as live auctions. That was the idea. I think reality hit a couple months after. We tried to really scale it. We built up the team. We raised a small round, which was in today's numbers a tiny round, but back then it was a sizable round, and then tried to scale and then, you know, quickly realized that that wasn't the winning idea, and we're actually having a very hard time acquiring users and then maintaining users, because people loved the idea, but then at the end of the day they went where the dollars were, and they were at eBay where the volume was and where sort of supply and demand met. So yeah, that was definitely, you know, a first learning, my first step into entrepreneurship and then starting a company where it didn't go the way we expected.
When you look at Zalando, what was the difference, let's say, in the metrics? Like, did you have a moment with Zalando like, oh shit, like this is completely different. The users are coming back. It's very easy to retain users. The wallet share is kind of increasing.
Yeah. So I think these were completely opposite examples almost, right? So the first company, I learned how it is when you don't have product market fit and you struggle achieving it. And then with Zalando, we actually saw the opposite. We saw consumers love the model. We went into the market with a back then very new value proposition, free shipping, free returns, huge selection. And that was not something that was being offered on the market elsewhere. And of course, you know, over time, many people jumped on that trend. Back then, we were really one of the first in Europe. And yeah, you see it. And you know, walk home and then you see the DHL truck and you see a Zalando package in the back and you're like, wow, somebody ordered. That's actually not a friend. And then you get some ideas that something's taking off. But you see it in the numbers. You check every day, see the growth, you see conversion rates, you see improvements. And that was always the thing I loved about Zalando, is like having the type of data which allows you to really do experiments and have very short feedback cycle. You try something, you launch a feature, you put a few hundred thousand visits on it, and the next day you basically see, has it worked or has it not worked?
When you look at these two examples, for founders listening, what would you say that is the best way, the most efficient way to pursue an idea and to be very systematic, to check quite periodically if you have product market fit, or if this is an idea that is worth pursuing? Because also, I guess in the early stages, it precedes, you don't necessarily have product market fit, but you're only kind of testing this idea.
Even after Zalando, you know, I was thinking about like what's next, and obviously we ended up doing Cherry. But you know, I was sitting there, you know, looking at different ideas with huge lists, pros, cons, etc. And obviously, you do all that. You want to, of course, be analytical. You want to see, how big is the market? Is my idea actually something that I love? Do other people see as well? So you want to test it with people. I don't really believe in keeping things a secret. At the end of the day, very, very few topics actually won, because the idea is the most amazing. I think it's very much about bringing it to life and executing. So my recommendation would be to be fairly open with what you're thinking about, and then try and get as many data points as possible before you start. But then also, don't overthink it, right? So it doesn't make sense to, because you could go on and on and on. And if you find an idea where there's no items on the com side, it's probably already been invented, or it's really, really boring and obvious, and it's very, very hard to make a big business out of it. So there is going to be known unknowns, and you have to accept these and you have to be comfortable with them. But then you also obviously want to, you know, add more data points along the way to get closer to the truth. And then I think the key element, once you have something, once you build something, is like put it in front of customers as early as possible, and can be, of course, in a close beta with you know, small groups of users. But I typically don't believe in, you know, building and it not showing anyone. And then this big magic moment where you come out with a product and then boom, you had thousands of users. That's almost never happening, because any product, no matter how good the idea is, needs time to evolve. And for that, you need feedback. You need constant feedback loops with the user. So rather test that early on. And then also have the courage to say it's not working. Well, I was just having lunch with the founder, and many examples as well in our portfolio of companies that have raised money and, you know, were very convinced of an idea. And then, you know, a few months in, they saw, you know, actually demand is not as strong as we thought, and the product idea may have not been the best, and product market fit is slow, or we're seeing very, very long sales cycles. And then I think the best founders realize, the best way is obviously realizing when you still have money in the bank, so you can pivot and try something else, and you learn, and you move, and you experiment. So I really like this, especially in the early stage, I really like this idea of experimenting your way to product market fit.
And also I like how David Friedberg puts it, like the persistent iterator,
yeah.
Right? You have to be persistent, but you have to iterate. And at the same time, you have to make sure that your learning velocity is quite high. So how many learnings do you have in, I don't know, like in 2 weeks and in 4 weeks? Because that means you're kind of optimizing, getting closer to the truth, as you put it.
Yeah, but also on the one hand, I think this is very much true. On the other hand, also don't underestimate the importance of having also a bold hypothesis, right? So if you're only asking for feedback from users all the time and you listen, 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 you tweak, it's very, very hard to make very bold product decisions. Like, I'm just going to ship this because I really believe in it. And, you know, I throw it against the wall and I see if it sticks. And so I think it's keeping a balance. Obviously, you want to create as much data as possible, you know, see small moments of truth. Ah, okay, it's working. I can go further there. Ah, this is not working, so let's scrap it. But then, you know, it's, you know, from time to time, you also have this, okay, this is really a bet that I'm making. And then sometimes trying to democratize it. So trying to get the majority likes it, the other part, 40% don't like it, so I don't do it. That sometimes doesn't lead to optimal results either. So don't forget to be bold. Obviously, you want to look at data, but don't forget to be bold at the same time.
Absolutely agree with it. I think actually Spotify, they had this concept called dibs. Taking bets over and over again, and you have intuition, and then you get a little bit of data, and then you can iterate on that. And do you remember a moment in time with Zalando where you were, shit, we're onto something that is actually bigger than we ever imagined? Or did you have some moments saying, like, I don't think that this is going to work?
I mean, to start with the latter, I think we had hundreds of moments where we were close to cash out. We didn't think things were working. We had some fires burning, the warehouse, or I don't know, customer service. You know, it's also a very, anyone has that has ever run an e-commerce business, like we're just saying, retail is detail, and it really is. Like, it's very, very complex operationally. You need to get a lot of things right, and it's almost impossible to control everything. So the moment you're growing fast, it's almost uncontrollable. So you have a feeling you have this old, you know, Golf 2 Volkswagen, and you're going on the German Autobahn and you're driving 200 kilometers per hour. And in the meantime, you're also changing the engine, right? So it's kind of a very roller coaster type environment. Yeah, we had many moments like that. Like, for example, we had this lawsuit, I think 2010, someone tried to sue us because they had a brand online as well that was called Kalando, written with a C. So at some point we thought we would have to change the entire brand. Of course, with all these investments having gone into marketing, like these type of moments, they happen at early stage, they happen at late stage. And the interesting thing is, if you then see an IPO, you always have this shiny growth story from the outside, but internally you have always a struggle. And then when did it work? I think the one of the magic moments I remember was when we booked our first TV advertising, which was unconventional, right? I think also different time, of course. You know, you have to say today it would probably work differently. TV has a different pull than a decade ago. But I think we were really smart about it, trying to orchestrate TV with different marketing channels on the online side. So more sort of direct to response channels like Google SEM, of course, and also display, affiliate, and then TV on top. So try and, you know, really see this as one of many marketing channels across the consumer journey. And then, you know, we had a couple of test runs and we had a really, really basic green screen, a woman juggling shoes and then some, you know, notes coming in, free shipping, free return, yada, 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 and then some nice music. So it was like a 10K TV spot. Then to see it and then see the impact, and you see traffic and then the side breaks and then you start wondering, what can you fix? So I think these type of moments where you're like, okay, wow, there is a lot of demand. And this is a very, very big market. And we're really onto something.
And we have a Volkswagen.
Yeah. And then over time, you build it into a, you know, maybe Golf 4 and then maybe Passat. And then you want to at some point end up with a BMW that's a little bit more resilient.
It kind of feels that as an entrepreneur, you always have to be maybe one or two steps back with on what you could deliver. And always you have to, well, like if the site is crashing, that's a good problem to have.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's the same. For example, if you look at hiring, sometimes it's something I always tell to our founders is like, punch above your weight class, right? To try and hire someone that's actually probably you think, he would never join this company. It's way too small for him or her. I think this is a good thing, right? So try and raise the bar. Try and think about who is that person that I'm bringing. Are they able to sort of bring this company to the next level? Am I as a founder able to learn from them? So I think in the same way, with sales as well, right? You're selling a product that maybe you haven't even built yet fully. Are you promising something? And then, of course, you go and build it. You have to deliver. But then, of course, being good at sales is a big part of the equation as well.
Absolutely agree. Eleanor Crespo from Pigment talks quite extensively on how crucial your early employees are and how much she, as a CEO, she would just court all this talent that have a tremendous experience that would maybe never would want to come and work for such a small company. But she said it's just worth all the effort. So if in 2 years or 1.5 years, I get this talent to join, it just makes such a big difference.
Yeah, I totally agree with her. And I think the impact of these early employees is so, it can be the magic moment of any company. And at the end of the day, you want to surround yourself with people that you can learn from, and also people that obviously believe in the dream and believe in your vision as a founder, but then also are able to multiply it and to make it their own and to expand it and to amplify it. Because at the end, it's this sort of first nucleus of people that you hire. If they're true to the core, if they're strong fit with the culture, with the DNA of the company, then this is the basis for scaling. If in this group there's one or two people that don't fit, or you think pretty smart, but you know maybe personal fit not quite right. So I would encourage people to the damage that these people can potentially cause along your journey is very, very big. So I would encourage any founder to rather overspend on time and probably also resources and probably also shares and ease up on building this initial nucleus that you need to be able to scale.
After Zalando, you founded Cherry Ventures. So what is the investment strategy and what do you guys invest in?
So we started investing as business angels, as many people do. So Christian and I, she sat next to each other at Zalando. Christian was the CMO, so he ran all the marketing. I ran product, so I needed to make sure that all the people that Christian brought to the site, that they eventually convert into buyers. So we had a lot of overlap and interaction. And we became friends, and you know, we're also quite complementary, so we like very, very different things. You can also see that if you look at our portfolio. And then we got together, we got asked by many founders, hey, look, we are starting something, and you want to invest, you want to support. So we started having these investment conversation. It's like usually late at night, there was a bar at the corner of the office where we would meet like after work and like listen to some pitches, and then started doing our first angel investments. And first we were doing them separately through our own investment entity. And then at some point we said like, look, why don't we, you know, do this from one entity. And then it was kind of without ever back then thinking about scaling this into an institutional fund. That was sort of the first small Cherry Ventures entity. And we wrote small checks back then. This was like 50K, 100K, sometimes even 30,000. Really, really small tickets into founders that we found inspiring and thought were ambitious. And over time, over a period of maybe 2 years, we built a small, really nice portfolio. Always with the idea in mind, okay, let's, you know, give back in a way. Like let's, you know, support, hopefully finding some of the Zalandos of tomorrow, to build a support background that we would have liked to have by our sides as founders. And that's very much still the DNA of Cherry. So when we then, you know, after the IPO, when we thought about, do we do this like properly now? We always kept that same spirit. Said, okay, we want to build the VC fund that we would have liked to have by our sides as founders, which is also why we as a firm, we're very, very focused. We don't have a growth fund, even though a ton of investors asked us, hey, you know, have a big portfolio, you could raise a growth fund, you can raise more money. Like, so we are really sticking to this seed to Series A stage where we invest and really build an engine that almost is a catalyst for founders getting from idea to product market fit. That's the idea of Cherry, and that's how we've designed the entire firm, whether it's our investment team or whether it's our strategic resources team that works with our portfolio.
Did you have any alignment discussion with Christian and say, hey, like, what are our values? What do we want to search? Or it was like you kind of saw that you're searching for the same type of talent in the beginning because it's just an idea stage. And then you just said, okay, let's do this together.
No, we talked about this very early on. And I do think that maybe also sets us apart a little bit from other funds that were, because we both ran companies before and we led big teams. And I think we don't necessarily think about Cherry so much as a fund. For us, it's also a company, right? So we think a lot about our values, our brands, what are the type of people that we're hiring? Just the same thing I've just described with founders of you know, tech companies. We are thinking the same way about our firm, like who do we bring? Who's that nucleus that supports that vision and that DNA? And I think one common denominator that we have in the firm is that pretty much everyone has been on the inside and has worked or even founded startup companies. So we have very, very few people that are coming from a corporate world or from consulting or from banking. Most of them have entrepreneurial DNA and are, or even founders themselves that they then have turned investors.
How do you try to build a culture of excellency? I know that also you guys are hiring right now. So when you go through the interview process, how do you make sure that this is the right person that is fit?
Yeah. So cool that you've seen the hiring post. It actually made quite an impact. So we were completely swamped with applications. So if anyone hasn't heard back, then I'm very sorry. But we're going through every single one of them. And then I think we're trying to run a process that's objective, at the same time, very, very detailed. So there are several steps. Usually at the beginning, we do a more quantitative assessment, which goes more into how analytical is a person. There's some, you know, we use a tool for that. And then obviously there's several interview steps where it's both us partners, but then also other people from the team interviewing, usually with a different focus in each interview, whether it's analytical skills or creativity or, you know, firm fit. So we try and structure it in a way that we then, you know, build a pipeline and from there arrive at, you know, a number of candidates that we feel are amazing. Then we always want to stay small as a firm, right? So we take a lot of time making that decisions because we feel like, okay, then, you know, the person joining hopefully will be with us for a long time. We don't want to also rush things there.
Absolutely. And what deep dive have you done recently that gets you excited?
I mean, the entire firm, the way we work is we obviously have a coverage element, which is more based on geography where people are. We have three offices, one in London, one in Stockholm, and then the main one in Berlin, which also represents the three major ecosystems where we invest. We invest all over Europe, but, you know, I have a company in Poland and different places, right? But the main focus is DACH, UK, and then the Nordics. And then we have a thematic focus that each of the team members and also the partners have. In my case, that's fintech. I spent the majority of my time, like recently we've looked a lot into B2B payments, how so the orchestration of payments is evolving, becoming more complex because you have different payment flows as well, more stakeholders that need to be integrated, complex APIs. So I think we're seeing a lot of innovation there, more on the back end. So it's more sort of more technical, more B2B. I haven't seen too much that excites me recently on the consumer fintech side of thing. Of course, you know, our partner Jasper, he spends a lot of time now in AI, as everyone. I think to be seen what remains from that hype. I think you have to really look behind the defensibility of many of those companies which use GPT as a technological backbone, which is interesting. But then again, like, how can you really build a defensible product? That's, of course, an area where we spend a lot of time. Climate tech and impact, which is another colleague of mine that's spending time on that, has been the main focus on the last fund as well, and still is, right? But, you know, Carboculture, Climate Tech, Atlas, like several other companies who have invested in, Infar is probably a bigger one, which is already dating back a little bit. Obviously, it's just like such a big problem. And we also see, and this is usually a good sign, a lot of really, really great talent going into that space, particularly experienced entrepreneurs and stuff like, maybe I've done a startup, now my next one, I don't just want it to be commercially successful, but I want to feel good about it every morning and say like, I'm really changing something for the better in this world. And hence we have a, I would say, high density of top talent going into that space. And this is then obviously also where we want to be.
Got it. So it's like fintech, AI, climate, and then you would look more opportunistically also in other areas? Or
there's more, right? So Christian, for example, he spends a lot of time in food. Obviously, you know, some overlap with impact there. If you look at sort of alt protein, and we have done a number of investments there over the last couple of years. B2B software has and always will be a main topic for the fund. So the way it works is typically as a partner, but also as, you know, any member of the investment team, you have your area of expertise that you build out, and it can be also a new topic for the fund that you look into, and then you build it out over time. We have a format every week where we get the entire team together, and it's just a learning forum where one of the team members presents. It can be, you know, a topic that, for example, it has to do with the company that we're working on, that we're due diligencing at the moment, but we have not done an investment in the space. So someone just, you know, brings new idea about the market that we haven't really looked into. Or it can be something, you know, completely unrelated, but, you know, just a great idea that someone saw and wants to talk about. So this forum we really use, and we make it a weekly format. It's not super, you know, formalized. Usually there's a small presentation, and then people learn from each other. And it's also really important for us, because then our team is out there and knows within the fintech space, Philip right now is looking for A, B, C. So they know when they see something in the Nordics, you know, most of the time I'm in Berlin, so they can flag it, and then we are faster because we already know what we're looking for. So that's a bit the way we work.
I remember actually doing this presentation for the previous fund about Web3 and why it's a structural trend and not a hype. But I guess what you see right now is the burst of the bubble, and now you kind of see like what's left from the good entrepreneurs and from the good ideas.
Yeah, I mean, we decided to do a crypto fund. We've always done a couple of crypto Web3 investments across the different funds that we had, but we really made it a dedicated setup this time. And we have Patrick and the team that run the crypto fund there. I think they're doing an amazing job. And of course, you know, there's been a lot of turmoil and the markets have tanked. And there's a lot of super overhyped projects, which I think are completely overvalued. But I think now it's actually a really, really good time. So because now the tourists go home, the market has corrected. The core of the technology is still very much intact, and it's growing. If you look at usage of the, you know, layer 2 Ethereum, for example, there's exciting projects being built now. And I think if you're then in a position to invest with less of the hype and less of the craziness, and probably also at slightly better valuations than in 2021, I think this is actually a pretty good place to be at the moment.
I agree. Everything is much cheaper. It's not that it's not the hype, but it's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
A lot of investors, like, they don't want to invest. So I think there are very few investors that, yeah, were independent thinkers in the sense that, look, this is our thesis. It's a structural trend. We still believe regarding of what the market believes. I think it was a generation maybe or like 20 years of momentum investing.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people were trained in momentum investing instead of kind of, look, this is a structural fund. This is what we truly believe in. So during this time, actually, things are cheaper.
Yeah, I think at the end, this is also who you want behind you as a founder, like people that fundamentally believe in the technology and in the market and don't necessarily just do the investment because they saw Andreessen raising a huge crypto fund, right? So I think you need to, at the end, go back to the basics. Like, how can you create value through that technology? And if you believe that, then fundamentally you will find value with a couple of these projects, right? And that's why I'm actually very, very happy that we've gone through the correction and we can now really focus on the people that are serious about it.
Yeah. Let's change gears a little bit. Is it true that the first million is the hardest to make?
Yeah, definitely. It's also, you know, it's so far away from, you know, being a student working on, in, you know, a super small budget, a few hundred euros a month, pay your apartment, your phone, your food, everything. And then I think that changes a lot, of course, you know. But then it also doesn't change that much, right? So, and I think over time it becomes more of a, of course, you know, it's easier than to accumulate wealth once you have some. But at the same time, should never change you as a person.
Yeah, it kind of feels that then maybe the intrinsic motivation has to be strong enough. And whatever you do, probably you want to do it because you're intrinsically motivated. Just going back to what you said, a lot of entrepreneurs that did something before, they want to maybe go into climate, some of them, because they're just intrinsically motivated.
Yeah, and then I think at the end, then you caught the buck or you didn't, right? At the end, if you're in it for the money, okay, you make money, then you do something else. Or you go to the beach or you open a kite school. But if you love building, if you love creating companies, and in our case, we're not building them themselves ourselves, but we are supporting super ambitious founders that are trying to change the world with something. And I think to be able to sit on the sidelines and help and support is something that, you know, we love doing every single day. And of course, you know, we will and want to make money with it, but it's not the primary motivation.
I agree. It's a lot of problem solving. No, it's like it's problem solving from different angles instead of kind of solving one problem and then kind of go a little bit more granular into it.
Yeah. When we decided together, ugly, that's to cherry. Of course, one of the things that I thought I was going to be missing was to be building my, to be sort of in the fire and, you know, I have to do this and fix this because it's my company. And if I don't do it, nobody else will. And of course, that's different as a VC. I think that you actually have to be careful not to involve yourself too much. At the end, it's always the founders that build the businesses. And we don't want to be a company builder. We are an investor. And at the same time, you can, you know, provide learnings. You then realize over time that you can actually make quite some impact just by sometimes just connecting the right people at the right point in time, you know, leveraging your network and then maybe sharing a little bit of your personal experience, but then also experience from other portfolio companies. We have, you know, over 100 right now. There's many, many problems that we've seen before. And I think this is, I believe, where our value or any investor's value can be.
What does success mean to you?
For me, success is going to the office every morning saying, wow, I love what I'm doing. You know, hopping on the phone with the founder and being super energized after it. You know, seeing companies thrive, seeing companies overcome struggles. I just love this whole idea of creation and innovation and building businesses, but, you know, also seeing people thrive over time. So I think sometimes it's so amazing to see when we invest in a founder and she's, you know, maybe or he, very shy, great idea, maybe, but not quite there yet in terms of, you know, pitching it and how these people evolve over time. Like good examples, Jochen from Flixbus, you know, they were fresh off BCG back then working on this idea. The bus market is going to change from a regulatory perspective. There's a couple of companies that will sort of go into it and we want to go into it. And we had this plan and this is massive PowerPoint deck that you would expect, of course, from a ex-BCG founder. And sometimes you're like, okay, well, can we actually build it? It turns out they can. And you see him today on stage and, you know, he's about to IPO the company. And it's been such an incredible journey to witness. And I think this is also sometimes really, really rewarding, just having spent time with these incredible people.
Beautiful. I must say that I also love working with entrepreneurs and be able to contribute as much as you can, you know, during their journey, because as you mentioned, in the end, it's also their journey. You're by any measure a very successful person. You've worked with one of the top companies in Europe, and now you're the founding partner of a top VC in Europe. What do you attribute your success to?
That's a good question. I think it's actually quite simple. I think it's just doing what you love and just following that. And I think you will automatically be good at it. And I think just doing more of the things you love and less of the things you don't will automatically make you more successful and make you a better person. Something I recommend to anyone, by the way, something I've actually done with a coach a few years back, like make a list of the things you hate, the things you dislike, the things you like, and the things you love. Like actually write it down, make four columns, write everything that you do in your daily life and put it in one of the columns. And then think about how can I do much, much more of the right side of the stuff you love. Almost nothing of the stuff you hate. You know, from time to time, you got to do something. Much less of the dislike stuff. Yeah, you know, it's never going to be zero, right? There's always going to be that call you don't really want to do, you need to do it. And then more of the stuff you like. And I think if you can follow that principle for a while, you actually see how your daily life changes, how you set up your company, how you focus on the stuff where you can really have impact. I think it's a good exercise.
Love that. Are you still using a coach?
Yeah. I've, you know, sometimes also, you know, go through different ones. And we also sometimes use someone as a team, which is also interesting. See complementarities, different, you know, team structures, weaknesses, strength, to also see where do we need to hire potentially to fill gaps. I truly believe in it. I think the power of having a good coach can be transformational.
Absolutely. And I know that you have to jump off. One last question. If Philip from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell him? So it's 2011.
There's a few companies I probably would say don't invest in them. But no, but more seriously, I would say, like, just go for it. At the end, don't overthink. Follow your intuition, follow your passion, follow what you love. And then I think you end up somewhere exciting.
Follow what you love.
Yeah.
Love it. Philip, thank you so much for taking the time. This was a pleasure.
No, likewise. It was fun.